It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 327. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me suggestions for any show topic. You can email me your tech questions. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message, and I have a great long, very good voicemail that I'm going to play later in a couple minutes. And the voicemail phone number is 240-949-2450. Don't forget the wiki at mtswiki.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. So we're going to dive right in. I have this really three sections for the show tonight. One, the first section, really wrapping up the server migration. Now, Winston and I did a server migration for a client. I did a whole show dedicated to it. We finally retired the server the other night. Winston was on the phone. I was on site. Oh my, I got to wait to hear that. Then the second segment, I have a 10-minute voicemail that I want you to hear that has a lot of good information about storing passwords in KeePass versus RoboForm, and then also encryption. Some really good feedback from a listener. And then the third part is going to be about my Windows 7 workstation migration project. Lots of things that I learned, things that I wish I could do over. So you're going to really benefit from what I learned from that project. To get started, when you do an SBS, small business server migration, going from 2003 to 2008, you have to go through a process to retire the old server. Well, the old server would not go quietly into the night. It would not retire. It would not cooperate. And it fought, taking its last breath, and fought us at every turn. Winston was team viewered into the 2008 server, and I was on site, and all we had to do was follow a procedure. Now, the procedure is to transfer some roles and things. That went great, but we had to uninstall Exchange Server. And one of the things that I ran into a problem with and why I needed to engage Winston's help, the bridge head connector connecting, and don't worry about the details of this, but it's a connector that from a software standpoint within Exchange to connect the two Exchange servers for the migration. And all we had to do was delete that, and it wouldn't delete. And you had to go to a commandlet program, this command line environment for Exchange on 2008. And we had to run this command to remove the connector. So I needed Winston's help. He remoted in. He nailed all of the syntax of this complex command to remove the connector. And it went with no error. I was like, great. So let me continue with the uninstall of Exchange, because it wouldn't uninstall, saying that this bridgehead connector was still there. Wouldn't work. I mean, it would not uninstall, and you have to uninstall Exchange cleanly. You can't just turn the server off and throw it away. You got to go through the procedure. After a while, we finally realized that, you know what, we're going to have to manually delete this connector. So he went in. There's two places where you delete it. We deleted it, crossed our fingers, started the Exchange uninstall process, and it started uninstalling. So we figured, we're there. The last piece is just to run DC Promo. Now, DC Promo is Domain Controller Promotion. This is how you make a regular server a domain controller, and this is how you undomain controller it. This is how you demote it back to a regular server. That's like the easiest command to run, you know, when you're going to demote a domain controller. You just run DC Promo. You make sure you answer the first question correctly, that we needed to say that this was not the last server in the domain. We run it. It errors out. Winston and I, in all of our years of working on domain controllers and doing this command, we have never seen this error. We have never seen it error out. It took us a couple tries. We did nothing. And then all of a sudden, it worked. And DC Promo started to run. And it started doing its thing. But it was just interesting that this whole migration on the server, every step of the way, this old server fought us at every turn. I forgot a piece. During the Exchange uninstall, it wanted the original CD2 to uninstall. I have no idea where my client would keep that. As a matter of fact, I think it's in a safe, which I don't have a combo to. And even then, I don't even know if it's going to be in there. Now, as luck would have it, this client is not very far from me. I went home to get my binder with all my CDs in it, and I had a set of small business server CDs from TechNet Plus for 2003. But a while back, I needed a CD that a client didn't have, and Winston kindly provided me the images of the three CDs for small business server 2003. So I had two sets. Of course, the set I used did not work. The set that I had made months in advance but kept the CDs, or actually DVDs, DVD 2 worked. And I put that in, Exchange was happy, and it could go through the process of uninstalling. I hate that old process of uninstalling, and I know that I think the newer software does not do that, at least Exchange 2007 and Server 2008, and even Office 2003, when you go to uninstall it, you need the CD. You know, Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom, I mean, why would you need the install CD to uninstall a program? I don't get it. There's no rationale why anybody would want to program that in. It doesn't make sense. But I was very fortunate. When you're in the server world, you got to make sure you have every version of everything possible that you could think of. And that's what's in this big black binder of CDs and DVDs. And just another reason for being a pack rat when it comes to that kind of things with software. And I'm glad that I am. And I had that, and that saved me the other night. Finally, the DC Promo succeeded, and I was able to finish off the commands. We were able to change from a domain to a work group. Then, when we're done, we go into Active Directory on Small Business Server 2008 and remove the server name. That was it. That was all she wrote. The server is retired. It's also sitting right behind me because I have to run DBAN and actually get rid of all the data. Now, my client kindly let me keep this server, the old server. I don't have enough pain in my life. I decided that I am going to reformat it, and I will share down the road the experiences of just doing a clean, fresh Small Business Server 2008. And I am going to run that on this box and from scratch, doing a by-the-book install. Let's see what happens. It does have 6 gigs of memory, where 2 was only accessible because my predecessor only put a 32-bit operating system on it. The processor is capable of doing 64-bit, even though this is an older server. So it should be able to handle it. There's not a lot of hard drive space, but I don't need a lot right now. So I'm going to play with that, and that's going to be my test bed for Small Business Server 2008. And actually, I'm going to make it my consulting company's server for MHS Consulting. That's going to be my box with an Exchange server on it. And let's see what happens. There'll be, I'm sure, stories from that. On to a different topic here. Paul, listener in San Antonio, Texas, put together a really great voicemail here. Give a listen.
Hey, Mike. This is Paul from San Antonio calling in again. I had a couple of comments regarding your last podcast, show number 326. I'll try to make this as brief as possible. You had a topic. You talked about the Microsoft EFS, which is the encrypting file system. And the question about that was why it isn't more widely recommended or discussed. And I just wanted to say myself that the reason I never recommend it to anybody is because of all the problems related to it. It uses certificates that are tied to the actual Windows user account. There are ways to make it work over a network in a enterprise environment, but it can get pretty complicated, and I have seen many problems when a computer goes down and you have to recover data off of it. If you don't have the certificates properly backed up or they're corrupted, you're pretty much SOL and you're not going to get all that data back. So I definitely don't recommend it, especially in an enterprise environment, because it's just another thing to maintain. It's normally not done right, and I've seen too many problems where important data gets lost because of the encrypting system. Even if you can recover the files themselves, if your certificates are not intact and you don't have a proper username associated with it, you're not going to be able to read the files. That's one of the biggest drawbacks with encryption in general. So typically what I recommend, I don't even use the Microsoft BitLocker with Windows 7 either. What I recommend is TrueCrypt because, one, it is free. Two, it is very robust, very reliable. However, I never use the full disk encryption feature. What I do is I create an encrypted container, which is mapped as if it's a separate drive. And that everything that I have that I want encrypted, all I have to do is to save them in that to that drive letter, and I know that they're protected. I can easily unmap that directory, connect it back up when I want, thus encrypting, decrypting on the fly as I need to. The one drawback with that, though, and most every other encryption software after that I've tried, is once you put it on a thumb drive and you try to use it as a portable app, that works fine. TrueCrypt does have the ability to encrypt an entire thumb drive. However, you will run into problems when you try to use it on a computer that you don't have administrative rights to, which is more than likely the case with your work PC. So it can be pretty frustrating to use it on your thumb drive, put files on there, and then you can't access them at work because you can't decrypt the files in order to see them. And that has to do with the fact that you just don't have the administrative permissions to do that. So what I do then, there's two other encryption products that I'll use depending on my need. One of them is AxeCrypt. Now, as far as portable goes, you have the same problem. You have to have admin rights to properly use it to encrypt and decrypt while on the go with your thumb drive. However, install on your PC, it's pretty easy to use. It can encrypt and decrypt, but what I really like is that it will also encrypt to a self-executable file. Once it's encrypted, in order to open it, you just double-click on the file, type in your password, and it unencrypts right then and there. The other nice advantage to that is that it also has the ability to retain the file associations. So let's say you have a Word document and you encrypt it to a encrypted executable. When you click on it and it prompts you for the password, it will not only decrypt it, but it will actually launch the file in Microsoft Word when it opens. So that's a nice feature there that saves you a couple of steps accessing the file. As far as what I do with portability using encryption on my thumb drive, what I do then, there is another product that I paid for a while back, and it's called File Encryption XP. You can get it online at cp-lab.com. And don't let the name fool you. Even though it has XP in the name, it will work in Windows 7 and other versions of Windows. It's $30 to purchase, but there is a 30-day free trial if you want to try it out. And when you buy it, you install it on your PC, and it works well on your PC, even with right-click context menus right in Windows Explorer. However, from the program itself, you can tell it to install a portable version onto your thumb drive. And in my experience, I've been able to install it on multiple thumb drives without any issue. You get the same full functioning program on your thumb drive, except for the fact that because it's portable, you don't get the right-click context menus, obviously, when you're using it in another PC. But it opens up with its own file manager. You can navigate to any file. And it pretty much has the same features as ACScript, except for the file association feature. But you can encrypt and decrypt on the fly, and it doesn't matter what user rights you have on the computer that your thumb drive is plugged into. So that's what I use for my portable solution. However, some files that I use ACScript for, with the self-executable feature, it encrypts and makes a .exe out of it. That file can be opened, decrypted, on any PC that you transfer it to, because what it needs to decrypt is built into the file itself. All you have to provide is your password. The drawback there is that once you open it and you edit it, you cannot re-encrypt it with ACScript. So that's the problem there, not being able to use it portably. So those are the three solutions I use depending on my need on a case-by-case basis, what I'm encrypting and what I need it for. If I need it on the go and be able to access it on my thumb drive wherever I'm at, I use the File Encryption XP. On my PC, I use TrueCrypt, sometimes in combination with ACScript. So those are the ways I go about it. But whatever tool you use, I highly recommend staying away from full disk encryption or the Windows electronic filing system, because both of those have a higher likelihood of you possibly not being able to access your files should you have to restore your system or your hard drive crashes. TrueCrypt does not have any other way for you to get in if you either forget the password or your hard drive becomes corrupted. You cannot repair it using Ultimate Boot CD or anything like that normally. Like you would any other PC. So you end up losing those files. And I forgot to mention, I also wanted to recommend RoboForm over KeePass Password Safe, which was discussed on that show. And again, and as far as going with security, RoboForm, like KeePass, does encrypt its database of all your logins. But I just feel that it's a much more robust solution, has many more features. I could go through them all, but that would easily take another 10 minutes explaining that. But lately, though, they have added some features that are new within the last few months, and one of them is RoboForm Online, which is at no extra cost, but it basically you can sync up your entire database to their online server. And the benefit to that is if you're out and about and you're on another computer, you don't necessarily have to have your thumb drive with the portable version of RoboForm on it. You can either open up another tab and navigate to RoboForm Online, log in there, and copy and paste your login, or you can use the RoboForm Online bookmarklet, which you can get from their website, and that'll go into the toolbar, and you click that, and you basically get the same functionality of the program right from that bookmarklet using JavaScript. So it can do pretty much everything that the program itself does. So that to me is a big selling point on it. They even give you the synchronization software to sync it up, as well as sync it to your PC or some other location to back up your database. And they give you that software free with RoboForm, where normally if you were to buy that software from them separately, it would cost you. So overall, I highly recommend RoboForm. I know KeePass is recommended a lot, but RoboForm does have many more features, including the ability to automate your login process on most of the websites that you have saved on there. And they have also announced that they will soon be rolling out functionality with programs that are installed on your computer. So not only can it navigate to a website, put in your login, and submit it for you, but it can do the same with programs that require logins. It will fill that in for you and log you into the program. So that's something I'm looking forward to. So again, just wanted to add that. Again, thank you, Mike, for your show, and I will talk to you again in the future. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul, for taking the time to describe all that. I have a comment on whole disk encryption. Paul is correct that it is very difficult. If you have a crash, the likelihood of you being able to get back in there to the drive and be able to fix whatever's wrong and get your data is very slim. I actually run into this. I have clients that have to have whole disk encryption, including my client with the Windows 7 migration. I have to pick a program that's going to do whole disk encryption. I have no choice. This is because of compliance. We can't just pick a container where you want to be portable, like Paul mentioned. That's a great idea. Now, if you don't have a requirement that you are forced to have whole disk encryption, then you want to follow Paul's procedure, which is probably most of you out there. But I have a client, has to have the whole disk encryption, and I am going to do a bake-off with two test units, one using Windows 7 BitLocker whole disk encryption, the other one, TrueCrypt, for the whole disk. I will let you know which one wins and why. So for a whole disk encryption, wait for a future show. For everything else, Paul is dead on, and that's exact. And I agree with his comments. Now, when it comes to KeePass versus RoboForm, remember, KeePass is free. You're not putting up any money for that. It's a great open source solution for storing your passwords. So it will have a couple less features than RoboForm. Now, one thing I didn't realize that Paul mentioned, RoboForm is going to support being able to enter passwords for programs, not just websites. So that is a great option if your company or client has trouble with a single sign-on, where you got old applications that still needs a password, where maybe someone is expected to remember three or four passwords to get into their applications. RoboForm, the new version, that could be a great time saver, and it's also encrypted, and the idea for it to be stored on a server, that's a great idea. I am actually going to give RoboForm another chance now, hearing about some of these new features, which I think you should also consider. All right, for the final segment, I want to talk about my Windows 7 workstation migration. One of the things that we did on the night before the rolling out the machines. This is a Friday night. My sons and I followed a script that I put together of checkboxes where we visited each workstation and copied the My Documents, the Desktop, and the Favorites folder. And then there was a couple other files that we grabbed. We also ran Moe's backup for backing up, and that's the Moe's stands for Mozilla, and we ran Moe's Backup Portable to capture all the Firefox settings. I go into some painful detail on a Tech Vets that is already recorded that you will hear. Matter of fact, there's two new Tech Vets shows that are in the can that are just waiting for me to edit and post. So just to let you know that. And one of them, I actually cover what I'm going to talk about right now a little bit, so it doesn't hurt to do it twice. Internet Explorer. Why did I not copy all of the Internet Explorer settings? Why? I can't believe this. And of course, after the migration, a mess. There were websites that were built into the security settings that were trusted sites. There were settings that caused complications for everybody to do it. Internet Explorer was not even on my checklist. I was so concerned with Favorites that I didn't think of all the other settings. That's why I wanted to make sure to cover this. You got to cover every application. I had every application covered, but for me, Internet Explorer was just the favorites because I'm not tweaking my Internet Explorer settings. Well, that doesn't mean your client is not tweaking them and that they've been tweaking them for the last several years for specialized websites that they're working on. I did not know this program exists. It's called BackRex, and I'm going to have the link in the show notes. This is now after the fact. I find a free program that literally takes all of those settings and it can migrate between versions. Another reason I didn't think of doing that, I didn't think I could. There would be a program that could handle going from IE7 to IE8, all the settings, because they were in the past, they were IE7 with XP. You get IE8 with Windows 7. So I blew that one, and that's why I have this show to share these kind of things. Mistakes that I make when you go forward and have to do some of this, or have a client or a project like this, or even for yourself for migrating, don't forget about those security settings and all of the other settings that go along with Internet Explorer. This BackRex works really good. Here's another one. Adobe Acrobat 9. They have the full version of Adobe Acrobat. They have a site license. I know it's very expensive. They have to have it for what they're doing. There is no substitute. Okay? So having Adobe Acrobat, I did not realize when I did a fresh install that there is one check that if you go into preferences and if you go to internet, there's just three options. One of the options is to render the PDFs fast when you're pulling from a website. By default, that is checked. Well, that causes problems with a couple of websites that they were visiting. And I learned that the hard way. And once we unchecked that, and I found that setting by having a very long conversation with Adobe, because I had a lot of Adobe issues. It was Adobe Acrobat. They have no way of you backing up their settings. So it would be like going into the registry and having to like dig them out and then exporting and importing, because they have no place. Because I asked them, I said, is there a place that I could go get the settings that you have buried somewheres? No, they don't. It's got to be the registry. And there were certain people that had certain toolbars on that I did not realize. So when you're doing a migration, you must make sure not take anything for granted, even a program as simple as Adobe Acrobat, in making sure that you have all of your settings covered, because that was another miss. And these two misses caused some grief for my client. So if I had to rate the server migration as a complete success, although it was a lot of pain on Winston and I, the Windows 7 workstation migration, there was no pain for me and my sons. We did a great job that weekend, and it went without a hitch. It went off. But it caused some pain for my client. So I don't call that a complete success. How I'm rating myself, I'm being tough, because my client looks at this whole project as a success, and they look at even those inconveniences, they were tolerable because I didn't allow them to last a long time for them to suffer. I tackled all the problems. I lived over with my client as each problem occurred. I tackled it, I solved it, and we moved on. That is the main thing. Even though there was some pain and a little suffering, I was right there to make sure that all of this was going to work and there wasn't going to be a problem. So you got to tackle the issues as they happen. Well, a couple things, and this one I mentioned in the last show, and I'm going to put this again in the show notes, the custom office toolbars. There's no way in the world that you wouldn't believe where they're located. And John, who the listener I thanked, who sent me a link to an article that I'm going to put into the show notes tonight from Microsoft, described exactly where those files are located, and also not only where they're located, but what files you would need to grab. That was really good. Another one, not to forget, and that is when you're dealing with Outlook, one of the biggest problems when you're moving to a new version of Outlook or a new computer, it's that NK2 autocomplete file. This is where someone starts typing. If you had sent a message to someone, their address is added to this autocomplete file, which is, again, buried within, you know, several directories. If you start typing and you begin typing the person's letter, it looks to that autocomplete and completes it. Well, that's built for over time. You don't want to lose that. A great utility from Neursoft, and that is the NK2 autocomplete utility. Again, one of those great utilities that's a must-have when you're migrating someone to a new computer and you're migrating them and they have Outlook. You're going to want that file. Another one, not to forget, everybody had printers. 4 people had a custom printer that was called the Zan Image Printer. You have to take a look at all of the printers that someone has on their system and take a look, because there could be software packages that created that printer. An example is this Zan Image Printer, which you can select, which it can do certain things with files. So they have some customization that they do for a particular file that's going to get filed within one of their client management systems. So very important. I had to not only make sure that this was installed for those people, I also had to make sure I got the registration information. That's another thing. Now, these are the things that I successfully migrated. They have a program that requires a deinstallation. So you have to deactivate it because they only had 3 licenses, and you can't reactivate it on the new computer until you deactivate it. I had to make sure that they were identified. Now, this was all the pre-work, so you can see where Adobe and IE got missed, because I had 30 other things that were detailed. We're talking a checklist that was multi-pages here. And you try to think of everything, but I will say this. I was working closely with one of the owners who knew all of their applications. Unfortunately, we think of Internet Explorer and Adobe as just generic enough that, you just install the new version, that's it, boom. You know, as long as it works, it works. What I should have done is taken this and ran it by another expert, even for a couple hours, and sat with them and had them take a look at my checklist. Another pair of IT eyes looking at your work could be well worth it, because you cannot think of everything. You can't. And you have to admit that and know that, and don't be afraid to seek advice. Now, here's what I offer. If you're running a project like this, where you're going to do a migration, I'm a perfect person for you to purchase for a couple hours to give my insight into this. That is an example. If you are going to migrate to Windows 7, then I would certainly be someone you would want to talk to about that, because I've been through it. I've now lived in the trenches going through a migration, and I might see things that you missed, and vice versa. That's why, bounce it off someone else who's not directly involved, so this way they can put a pair of fresh eyes. So like an editor to a book, you need someone to step away and take a look at your checklist, take a look at what you're doing. Now, the final piece of this is printing. I had a pretty easy go of it, but here's a great question from Jim in the chat. And he says, I have a question that I hope you can cover on Thursday's show. It's regarding 64-bit Windows print servers. In our organization, we have both a 32-bit and 64-bit print server. I feel that only one server is needed. But the question is, how do you add both 32 and 64-bit print drivers on the same server and have both 32 and 64-bit clients install the correct driver when I install from the workstation? Something I learned about Windows 7. When you click a network printer and click connect to install, client Windows 7, regardless if it's 32 or 64-bit, will look at the driver that you're trying to pass down. And if it's not right, it goes right out to the internet. And if it's available, it will find it. So you got to make sure that you're serving up printers that have 32-bit and 64-bit drivers. Don't worry about it. I only installed the 64-bit, but remember, all my workstations were 64-bit. But here's what happened. On even a local printer that was connected, I said, load the driver, and you know what it did? It went out to the internet, it just grabbed the right driver, and it brought it down. That does not happen with all printers. So a few weeks ago, well before this migration, I had an inventory of every local printer and every network printer, and thank goodness most of them were HP, and I went only because it made it easy to just go to HP, and I looked up each model and checked off whether the driver was included in Windows 7 base install. Did it have to be downloaded, or did I have to have a compatible driver, or there was none? Now, luckily, I didn't have to worry about none, but I did have to worry about a compatibility printer. The HP 6221, I think, inkjet, which of course they had a half a dozen of them, they don't have a driver for that. I had, but HP told me that the 990C driver was compatible. Now, Jim, I know I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent here for you, but you need to just worry about, I believe, the 64-bit driver. So here's my question. I would install the server Windows 2008 64-bit. I would load the print drivers on that, and I would load the 64-bit driver because that's what's naturally it's going to pull. And then isolate that and have a system that is 32-bit and have it try to pull it. And you know what? I think it's going to work. And it really depends on the printer and how their driver reacts. I'd be curious to know what you tried and didn't work. That's how I would approach it. I would only serve up the 64-bit. And for XP workstations, I don't believe you can downgrade and have the XP driver. What I would do is then just pull that from a central network install point and just have the XP driver for the XP machines. You're not going to be able to pull that from the network unless you go to a server that can serve that up, like a Windows 2003. Here's an idea, and maybe this is the best answer. How about one machine with virtual servers, virtual print servers, and each one, maybe you need three, an XP for 32-bit, a 2008 32-bit, and a 2008 64-bit. Three virtual systems just for print serving on one server. Something to think about. If the environment's big enough, that may solve your problem. So you don't have to worry about supporting multiple physical servers, print servers, support virtual servers. And you can use VMware Server. It's free. That may help you out. Small business specialist mentioned the client access licenses could kill you. You'd have to work out the licensing, but that's something that's how I would probably approach it. Let me know your feedback on all of this, where I talked about the finalizing the server migration, the great voicemail on encryption, whether it be, you know, portable encryption, whole disk encryption, the new version of RoboForms, and then my Windows 7 workstation migration project as I conclude right now the talking about that project, which has consumed my life over the past month with many, many hours, but a great project, great success. And now I'm looking on to bigger, better things and different projects and more work. With that, I want to thank you so much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please remember to help support the show by going to MikeNation.net, MikeTechShow.com. And on the left-hand side, the affiliate links, you have a link to my Amazon link where you can purchase all your Amazon items, and a little piece is donated to the show. And also the great, great tutorials, video tutorials on repairing your laptop repair videos, and also creating your tech repair website from Steve Cherubino. And then also, don't forget, I have that donation button on the right-hand side, because you know there are no more sponsors on the Mike Tech Show. We are self-sufficient. That is it. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.